All right, open your Bibles, Acts chapter 18. Before we get started, we're going to kind of do a quick review as we always do. Second missionary journey started out where? Antioch. And he goes up to some of the same cities that he had covered in his first missionary journey. Lystra, Derbe, Iconium. He then travels up into, or he wants to travel into Asia, but the Spirit doesn't allow him to do that. Then he travels up to Thia area, wanting to go into Bithynia. Spirit doesn't want him going there. So where does he go next? Troas. Right? And from Troas, he has a vision. And what does he see in that vision? Man from Macedonia. And what does the man say? Come over and help us. And he goes and he lands, or and he ends up at Philippi. And what are some of the one of the disciples who became a disciple? What was her name at Philippi? Lydia. All right. And then he travels to Thessalonica. All right. And then he travels where? To Berea. And what was interesting about Berea? What were they? All right, more noble, and what? In talking about them being more noble, what was brought out that they did that the people from Thessalonica didn't do? All right, studying. They searched the scriptures, and so they listened to this man. Where did he go again? Into the synagogues. All right, and they listened to him, and yet they were willing to open the scriptures and to study from that. And then from Berea, he goes to Athens. And what happens at Athens, right? All right. And what does he see in Athens that really allows him to speak what he wants to speak? All right. Lots and lots of idols, right? And then there was an inscription to this unknown god. And so he goes into the he has his discourse in the midst of the Areopagus. And then Brother Jimmy brought out a good point, which, you know, we read these things and we read them sometimes and we don't see that. And he brought out a good point. Same results that we see today, right? Some mock, some laugh. Ah, you know, we don't need that. Some listened and they commented, yeah, we may listen to you again sometime. And then some actually listened and it touched their heart. And they believed and they joined him. Paul then departs from Athens and he travels to Corinth. All right. So let's talk a little bit about Corinth. I think most of us know the basics. I don't think I'm going to say anything new here. Approximately 48 miles west of Athens. It was founded in the 10th century, largest city in ancient Greece, but more importantly, it was its richest port. And we'll talk a little bit more about that and the culture that it had. It reached its peak around the 8th century B.C., but it was destroyed in 146 B.C. by a Roman. They were actually the capital of a rebellion that came up, and apparently the Romans didn't like that. So he came in and basically destroyed the city. So the Corinth that Paul is visiting is different than the classical age, it's what some of the commentators talk about. It was rebuilt by Julius Caesar in 46 B.C., populated by conscripted Italians, Greeks, Syrians, Egyptians, and Judean freed slaves. And one of the things I read, one of the historical points, was it had about 700,000 citizens at this time. 200,000 were free and 500,000 were slaves. So I thought that was kind of interesting. All right. Approximately 50 A.D. when Paul visited, it was the most beautiful modern industrial city of its size in Greece. Now, going back to the heyday, I would say, back in the 8th century, there were lots of cults, there was lots of gods from all the different areas around, and there was a temple to Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and that during that time it had 1,000 prostitutes that plied their trade in the name of worship. And so, of course, just recognizing that, we can imagine what type of city it was. Now, that was the 8th century, and Paul now is visiting it in around 50 A.D. This is just, of course, most of the temples were destroyed in 146. This is a current temple of Apollo And actually, if you they've got a little webcam, and I was going to take a picture of it today, but when I got on there, it was already night, so it wasn't too good. But this is just one of the temples that still remains in there today. Okay, even by the classical age, around the 8th century, it had garnered unsavory reputation. All right, the name Corinth became synonymous for immorality. This word, I'm not going to try and pronounce it, but it means to live like a Corinthian. Had become part of the Greek language, and it basically meant to live with drunken and immoral debauchery. So, from a map standpoint, just to kind of explain some of the commercial advantages that Corinth held, of course, this is Greece. This whole area was Achaia. It was known as Peloponnesus, I guess, but it was after a god, one of the gods that they believed in, Pelop. All right, so it was commonly known as that. Of course, Athens is here, and he had just come from up here, travels to Corinth, and this little isthmus right there, all right, 4 miles across right there. And so what advantage would, of course, how was the major trade back in those days? How was it? By boat, right? So I didn't have time to get a big one, but if you kind of imagine a bigger picture, you've got Asia over here, Asia Minor, and what have you got over here? Italy, Rome. All right, so they're taking trade from over here and they're going here, and what would be the best route? Right through here. All right, over 200 miles of treacherous sea if they didn't go through there. So they would bring the ships in, and some of the smaller ships, they would actually pull them out and push them across the 4 miles to get to this other one. Some of the larger ships, they would just unload all the cargo, take it across the isthmus, load it onto another ship. And so what are you gonna see here in Corinth from a population standpoint? You're gonna have people that live there all the time, right? But what else are you gonna have? Lots of sailors. All right. And I'm not trying to lump all sailors into this, because there may be some Navy people in here. So. But typically, sometimes sailors have a reputation of traveling to foreign ports and doing things that they probably shouldn't be doing. And I would say that happened at Corinth. And that's probably why they found it advantageous to have a temple to Aphrodite with 1,000 prostitutes, because they probably made quite a bit of money in plying their trade. So, but later on, this environment that had been over centuries, really, and yet being destroyed because of the importance of that location, of course, there grew another city. And then when Julius Caesar came in, he recognized the importance of it, and he made it a Roman colony. And of course, that was to get whatever money they were going to be charging for transporting all of this cargo across. And then, just a note, I think it was around 86 A.D., Nero comes down and has a golden shovel, and he digs the first spade of dirt to dig a canal across the isthmus. So, flat time ago, they had a plan of digging through that, and they actually finished it in 1838. All right, so now that there's a canal that goes across here where some of the shipping can go across. So kind of got an idea from a picture standpoint of where Athens and Corinth is. And so when we start talking about some of the, especially when in the next quarter, if you were going to be in here, and we start looking at Corinthians and all of that, and some of the situations that the Corinthian church was having to deal with, maybe you can better understand. It helps me anyway to realize the environment that they were living in. Comments or anybody that may have a little bit more knowledge on anything? Wow. Yeah, you can do a Google Maps and you can, you know, yeah. And yeah, especially before it was there and pushing those ships across. So, all right. Chapter 18. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently came from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and so he came to them. So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers. I apologize, I'm going to have to turn back and forth, I forgot to print off my notes. And so we see him going into Corinth, And who is he with at this time? I believe he's by himself. All right? We're going to see where Timothy is in just a minute. But he's by himself. And so, you know, when I was studying this, you know, just trying to imagine the purpose of him traveling by himself, and he walks into this environment that we've just talked about. That'd be pretty intimidating, wouldn't it? And so, how do you think he felt when he found Aquila and Priscilla? First of all, he was all by himself. He was going to have to take care of himself somehow. And all of a sudden, he finds people who are worshipers, and they're actually the same occupation he is. So I can just imagine, we don't have anything written, but I can just imagine that it eased his mind a bit. Now, but what did Paul do? He reasoned, verse 4, reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. We saw in verse 2, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. According to the Roman historian Suetonius, Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome in 49 AD because the Jews were in a state of constant tumult at the instigation of one Crestus, which is Christ. Now, could we imagine the Jews being upset about all that? Kind of what we've been studying about this quarter, isn't it? All right, so that's why Aquila and Priscilla were there. Paul reasons again in the synagogue, as was his custom. And then in verse 5 it says, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. What do you think it means here to be compelled by the Spirit? One commentator I read mentioned, and I'm not saying that this is actually that it could have been that when Paul was reasoning in the synagogue by himself, he was teaching that the Messiah was to come and who he was and all that. Then when Timothy and Silas show up, he begins to tell them that this Jesus that he's been talking about, he is the Messiah. And then the Jews, you know, he's basically telling the Jews what they've been reading in their law, and now he's saying, hey, this person that I'm teaching of you now, he's the Messiah. And it was just his idea. I'm not saying that that's exactly what happened, but that triggering of Silas and Timothy being there, that support that they had, may have compelled him to now stand up and speak the truth about who the Messiah was. Brent? No, yeah, it could be. And that's why I tried to preface it being, this is just what one of the commentators said. I'm not saying that that's the way it was. But I agree with you. And it very well could be. I tried to read as many as I could get my hands on, and there's differing opinions. You know, I kind of agree with what Brent says. That, you know, just he recognized that, you know, I've got to get down to the core. I've got to get down and tell them who this Messiah is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Fire within me. Yeah. So. I just wanted to share what one commentator that I thought, and it, you know, it's an interesting thought. I don't want to imply that that's exactly what happened, but it's something that we can ponder about. All we do know was that he was compelled by the Spirit to testify. All right, and of course, how did they react? They start to oppose him, and what does Paul do? Shakes his garment. We've talked about that a couple of times, right? That's symbolic. But what else was it? Not only was it symbolic, it was a command, right? It was a directive from Christ. If they don't accept what you're teaching them, take the dust off your feet and move on. And that's kind of what he said. It's a symbolic thing of, hey, I've tried my best to teach you the truth. It's not on me now. It's on you. That's kind of what he says in verse 6. Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. And of course, we see later on that he still goes into the synagogue, so we don't want to take that comment of, I'm no longer going to preach to the Jews. But I think Paul recognized, first of all, Jesus told him at his conversion that he was going to be a light to the Gentiles. But also, you know, I think Paul recognized that he was getting more response from the Gentiles. And it's probably just human nature to want to go and teach to people who want to hear, who are interested in hearing. And so, when you read that, you know, the first thing that popped into my mind is, well, wait a minute, he's still going to the Jews later on. So I don't want to get him, or We don't want to imply that he wasn't going to be teaching to the Jews anymore. All right, he departs from there and enters into the house of justice, and we're told that he is one who worshiped God. And where was his house? All right next to the synagogue, so he didn't travel too far away, right? And then we're told in verse 9 of Crispus. And who was Crispus? Ruler of the synagogue. And what does Crispus do that's important not only for him, but maybe for those who may have been within the synagogue? Believes. Begins he believes on the Lord with all of his household. And then we're told that many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. And so we may get an idea that, you know, the old saying, I forgot the little story tale, but, you know, pull the finger away from the dike and then the water breaks through, right? That's kind of the idea that I got. I'm not saying that that was the driving force, but we as a human race sometimes, some of us are afraid to step out there and be the first one sometimes. And yet when someone else, we don't mind being the second one. And when that first one, you know, kind of, and that's kind of the idea that, from the way it's written, is that here is the ruler of the synagogue, and he hears the truth, he believes, he and his household are baptized, and then we're told that many of them believed. So he could be an example for others around him. All right, let's turn over to hold your place there. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. We have to remember, and this is one of the things, and I've been through this class, but being able to study it taking the time to study it in depth. I had the opportunity, but it helps me because it forces me to do something that I should be doing anyway. But it also helps me to remember when I'm reading 1 Corinthians, now hopefully I'll have a better idea of the situations that Paul and other disciples were in when he writes certain things. And 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 3, let's just start with verse 1. And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. All right, so he's writing this several years later, but he's telling them how he felt while he was with them. Weakness, fear, and in much trembling. Now let's turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. And I'm going to jump back and forth. In verse 5, back in 18, you don't turn back there. But when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, okay, that's when he was compelled to speak. Now in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 6 through 8, he writes, "But now that Timothy has come," so now, He's in Corinth when he's writing this letter, which we'll begin on Sunday, all right, going through the letters to the Thessalonians. "But now that Timothy has come to us from you and brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always have good remembrance of, greatly desiring to see us as we also to see you. Therefore, brethren, in all our affliction and distress, we were comforted concerning you by your faith. For we now live if you stand fast in the Lord." All right, so when we look at that and we see that he was in weakness and fear and much trembling, he's in affliction and distress, now might have been the time during these feelings that he had that the Lord visits him. Let's turn back to Acts chapter 18 right now. Verse 9. "Now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. Do not be afraid, but speak. And do not keep silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city." So when I gather those bits and pieces from the letters that he wrote, it really made me understand comfort that he must have felt when God came down and told him those words. When we're in situations, we're under distress and afflictions or whatever, does God talk to us? I think we probably all have those key verses that we turn to when we're in those situations. That is God talking to us. We allow Him to touch our heart. He will comfort us with His Word. That's what we can learn from this. Paul was in weakness. He was in fear and in much trembling. He was in affliction and distress. And God comes down and says, do not be afraid and do not keep silent.
Right.
So the comfort that we can, we know that came upon Paul, God came down and told him that. And that's some things that we can learn moving forward when we find ourselves. Find those verses. Proverbs 3, 5 and 6. Favorite verse. Turn there all the time. That's what I have to put my trust in. Find those favorite verses that you know when you're in those dire straits that you can turn to and allow God to come into your heart and comfort you. And I think we can learn this, Paul. Any comments, questions? All right. Paul stays in Corinth 18 months, a year and a half, teaching the Word of God. This is the longest that he stayed anywhere on his travels so far. So, I believe we can imply from that that he recognized that the ground was fertile, that there were souls out there to be saved, and that's what God wanted him to do, was to stay there. And it tells us, what does he do? Teaches. He's not just staying there, hey, Aquila, Priscilla, and my buddies or whatever. No, that he's staying there teaching the Word of God. All right. The Jews are going to come back into the scene and they're going to stir up some trouble. Verse 12. Gallio was proconsul of Achaia. The Jews, with one accord, rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat. Now, this judgment seat was not in a court of law, so to speak, that we would think of today. It was actually kind of in the marketplace, I believe, is where it was. And people could bring whatever they wanted to and discuss with this person. And so there's going to be other people around while the Jews bring up Paul. And they state, this fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. And then when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you. But if it is a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourself, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters. We need to also understand that, sometimes in the past, Paul was brought before the magistrates or whatever, and it was, hey, he's breaking your law. And what is it this time? Hey, he's breaking our law. And they don't really get the response that I believe they were looking for. Now, Gallio was a brother to Seneca, famous Roman moralist, who thought of him as a man of high integrity, amiable, and popular. And of course, when he's about to speak, he chastises the Jews about using him to deal with an issue that was apparently a question of words between themselves. He said, she said, whatever. Seneca actually is given a quote about Gallio, his brother. It says, no mortal man is so sweet to any single person as he is to all mankind. Even those who love my brother Gallio to the utmost of their power, yet do love not him enough. And that was a quote, because I wouldn't have written it like that. But it's interesting. It kind of tells you, sheds some light on the personality of this person. And it sounds like that's one of the reasons he wasn't interested in getting in between this conflict between these people. I'm not interested in settling that. You go off and you do your own thing. Of course, another interesting thing is both brothers committed suicide. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Footnote there. All right. So he drove them from the judgment seat. And so what did the Jews do? Well, that didn't work, so I guess we're just going to have to sit back and relax. Well, actually, it sounds like that the people that were standing around listening to them go, hey, look what they tried to do to that dude. And here their proconsul is saying, you know what, it's not even worth my time. Just get on out of here. So what do the Greeks do? Well, we'll fix them. And so what do? They go out and they find their own person, right? So they go and they take Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and they beat him. All right? I think the Jews were hoping that, let's take Paul and let's beat him. And what happens? A few minutes later, their leader is getting beaten, and where? In front of the judgment seat. What does Gallio do? You guys deal with it amongst yourself. That's kind of, you know, exactly what I said 10 minutes ago. You guys deal with it amongst yourself. And so he just kind of, sounds like he just kind of sat there and was entertained for a little while. So that kind of probably had a negative effect on the Jews in trying to stop Paul when they found out that the rulers of their area really didn't want to have much to do with it at all. All right, any questions or comments before we move on? All right, verses 18 through 22. Brent, you want to read that for me? All right, so Paul set sail, and apparently, well, after a year and a half, you know, you're going to become well acquainted with whoever you're staying with, and we don't read of anywhere where Paul goes off and stays somewhere else, so I think we can assume that he probably stayed with Aquila and Priscilla. And this won't be the last time that we hear of Aquila and Priscilla. He says in several of his letters that they greet the Christians wherever he's writing to. And so I believe that they were still a major part in his life in helping him spread the word. It's noted that Paul cuts his hair at Cenchrea as he had taken a vow. And I don't want to get in too deep in this. Now, if you go back to Numbers chapter 6, there is reference to a Nazarite vow. We're not really sure if this was a vow, but one thing we do know is that he didn't follow it to the letter if it was. Because what happens, where does they get their hair cut? The door of the temple, and what happens to their hair? Priests actually burn it in the sacrifice that they brought. So, I think we just need to be careful saying that this was a Nazarite vow. He took a vow, and at the end of his vow, he shaved his head. And that's where I'm going to leave it. But I did make a note in my own Bible for my own reference moving forward. Go back and read Numbers 6, verses 13 through 21. Very specific about what that vow was, what they were to bring, what the priest did with the fat from the sacrifice and all that sort of stuff. So, but the main thing is, it doesn't tell, I mean, he wasn't at the temple, and he doesn't say that he was offering a sacrifice and the priest took it. So, I think we just need to be careful saying that it was a Nazarite vow. Any comments on that? Oh, good point. Yeah, no, I didn't. Okay. Right. All right, but I have heard some people say that it was a Nazarite vow, and now I'm not going to say that anymore. If I ever said it, I can't remember if I said it or not. But doing some little studying, a little research, all I'm going to say is that he took a vow, and at the end of it, he shaved his head. All right, so they land at Ephesus. Paul leaves his traveling companions there, and what does he do? Going to go preach to the Gentiles. And the next city he goes to the Jews. So still going to be reaching out to the Jews everywhere he goes. All right, he reasons with the Jews. All right, so he's at Corinth, travels over to Ephesus. What did they want after he reasoned with them? Please stay. And he goes, I can't stay. I get back. But he does make plans, and you'll see later on that he does go back to Ephesus. He leaves Ephesus, travels down to Caesarea, and I don't know which. I think most of the maps that I looked at actually have, it doesn't matter, but actually have him going over here, but I think on his trip to Rome, it specifically says they came over this way, so that's the way I drew mine. And then once he gets to Caesarea, where does he go? He goes back to Antioch, and what does he do at Antioch? What's he do when he? What did he do when he got back from his first missionary trip? Well, he gives them a report, and so he's going to come back and he's going to talk to them about all the things that happened during. Questions or comments before we take our test? I'm just joking. So, if you want to, you can fill it out. We're going to go through the first missionary journey again, and then we'll go back through the second missionary journey, and then I'll show you the PowerPoint that goes with the map. All right, do I have a volunteer? Point this out before I hit the buttons. All right, first missionary journey. Anybody want to walk through it? Volunteers, volunteers, volunteers. Going once, going twice. All right. He starts out at Antioch, right? Let's see if I can do it. I'll put myself on the spot. All right. Goes to Antioch, travels to Seleucia, travels down to Cyprus, teaches for a while in Salamis, travels across Cyprus to Paphos. Sergius Paulus. Correct me if I'm wrong, okay? And Elias, he strikes him blind. Sergius Paulus converts. From there, he travels up to Perga. Travels upriver to Antioch. I'm just going to go through the cities. I'm trying to, all the different things that happened to them. All right, so it goes from Antioch to Iconium, from Iconium to Lystra, Lystra to Derbe, Derbe all the way back through Antioch down to Perga. Then he stops at Attalia and preaches there and then travels back to Antioch. So let's see if I was right. Go back to Perga and back to Antioch. All right? So there, you know, you can draw that out of your map. I mean, I highly suggest it. I mean, of course, I've been looking at this over and over and over again. It's helped, believe me, it has helped me. And now what I want to do is not do it again the next time I teach the class in 3 years. That's my challenge. Okay. All right. Now, so everybody's got this because we just went through this, right? So where do we start again? Antioch. And he travels around Syria, Cilicia. He ends up in the Derbe, Lystra, Iconium area. They welcome him, and they are glad to see him. Once he travels from there, he wants to go into the Asia, this area. The Spirit tells him no, he doesn't want to go there. He travels up to this Mysia area, wants to go over into Bithynia. The Spirit goes, no, I don't think so. He goes to Troas. While at Troas, he sees a vision. A man from Macedonia. Now, does he land at, help me out, does he land at Neapolis? I think he does, and then goes over to Philippi. And then that's where we say, I've just got the arrow going to Philippi. So I think somebody look that up. Hell, there's a couple people shaking their heads, and I trust you. But somebody look that up for me. All right. He travels to Philippi. Meets Lydia. Where does he meet Lydia? By the river. And what was Lydia doing? Pray. All right. And after she listens to them, she's converted. What does she do then? Shows another characteristic of Lydia. All right. The New King James Version says she begged them to come to her house. All right. Hospitality. Philippi travels over to Thessalonica. Thessalonica goes to Berea. Didn't have a good result in Thessalonica. Goes to Berea. The Bereans were more noble than those in Thessalonica because, as we talked about earlier, they searched the Scriptures. Then Paul was taken down the coast, down to the Athens area, and he's walking around. He sees all of these idols. He sees this idol to the unknown, and he gives his discourse on Mars Hill. Travels over to Corinth. And that, since we just went through today, goes from Corinth to Ephesus, Ephesus back to Caesarea, Caesarea to Antioch. All right. I'm glad I got that right. Okay, so they go through there. All right, real quick. This is the map that I gave you. Like I said, if you guys want a copy of this for your classes, you can either see Larry or I. Some of you may already have it. And then basically, you know, the PowerPoint is going to take you all through the lands. And then it's going to start with some of the cities, and it's actually a pretty neat little thing. And it's going to help. I'm going to go work through it because I want to learn a bit more. But if anybody wants a copy of that, just see Larry or I, and we'll get you a copy of it. If you, there'll be maps in here. If you want to come in and make another one to hand out, I'll do a couple of the alphabetically, and so you can hand those out to you guys whatever you want. All right. Any questions, comments before we leave? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.